Sona, sorry.
It's okay.
She had been talking to us about the Boltzmann equation.
Yeah.
That's welcome.
I have to put this thing on, right?
You put that in your back pocket and then clip this.
Clip this to where? To my shirt.
Right here.
Okay. Like this? Okay, so does anyone know what the Boltzmann equation is? Yeah? Yeah, kind of. Sort of, yeah. So if you think of all the particles of air in this room and how they're moving around, the Boltzmann equation basically describes that. The problem, what makes it so difficult is that, so there are different things that influence how these particles move around. In fact, there's like a ton of them, right? Like me speaking and just like any, like somebody moving or whatever, like if you have an AC, all of that kind of influences how they move, especially the collisions of the particles with each other. The thing is, the things that I just mentioned before collisions, those are, they're called like drift motion. So basically, we know how to deal with that because it could be, it's like the same as if it were water, you know, like I can like push water molecules around. So that's either a separate problem or easily done. So we're just going to pretend that we're not going to think about that. So we're just going to think about the collisions, because the collisions is what makes this so difficult. So this problem was posed in 1872, so that's 141 years ago, and no one has been able to solve it since. Let's set up the problem. So we're going to pretend that we have some container, a volume V, or we can just call the container V, whatever. We're going to assume that there are no drift motion. So the only thing that influences how these molecules move around is just their collisions. So there's no external forces. And these things, they move in lines until they collide, and then they move in, you know, so it's completely linear. We're going to assume that only two particles can collide at once, because having three collide at once is, like, the probability of that is, like, really, really, really low. So we're just going to pretend that doesn't happen. We're going to model these collisions like billiard balls. So you know when you play pool and you hit the ball and it kind of hits the wall and then it kind of bounces back at the same exact angle. That's what we mean by billiard ball collisions. And we're going to say that each particle has its own state. And that state, so the state of a particle, we call it TXV. So X, these are actually vectors. So we're in three dimensions. So this is X1, X2, X3, and V is V1, V2, V3. So I'm saying that a certain particle has this state if it's in position X, going at a velocity v at this time t, okay? So that's all it means. And we're going to define, f of t x v. It's going to be a probability density. Because there are so many molecules, we can't keep track of each one. So it's going to be, basically, think of it as the probability that a particle is in state T, X, and V. Okay? And this is what we're going to solve for, or try to solve for. So let me introduce the equation to you. So the Boltzmann transport equation. Goes as follows. So we have the partial of f with respect to time plus velocity dotted with the space gradient of f. Does everyone know what this means? So it's just, it's basically a three-dimensional vector consisting of the partials of f with respect to each of the x-coordinates. Right, so this is a three-dimensional vector, this is a three-dimensional vector, and we're dotting them together. So all of that is equal to j of f and f. Okay, so this right here is the equation. Oh, and also we should put in some initial data. So when time is zero, we're going to say this is going to be phi of x and v. So here's our equation. If this were 0 over here, the right-hand side, we would just have the transport equation. And that's something that we can deal with easily. This j right here, j of f and f, is going to be the whole problem. It's what makes it so crazy. So let me tell you what j looks like. And then it's going to look scary, but that's okay. Okay, so we have, okay, I'm also going to introduce a ton of new variables. And d sigma d v star. Okay, so let's talk about what this means briefly. You don't have to spend too much time on it. So what are these v stars, v primes, and all that? So basically, v and v star, or v prime and v star prime, are the velocities of two particles before they collide. So let's say this is v prime, and this is v, let's use a different color, and this is v star prime. So let's say this guy is going this way, and then let's say this is where they collide, right here. And then when it comes here, remember it's a billiard balls model, so it's going to bounce back this way, and that's going to be v. And then this guy is going to come here and then bounce back with v star, or with v star, yeah. So these are the velocities. This b right here, it has something to do with like some cross-sectional something. And we're not going to worry about what that is. The only thing that I'm going to say about this is that we're going to assume this b is nice enough that makes this integral finite. Not only that, but if we were to split this up into two integrals, both of those integrals would be finite. That this b being bounded or integrable, whatever, is going to allow us to move on. Okay, so let's continue. So we are actually going to split this up into two integrals. The first one is going to be the integral of this thing times b d sigma dv star. So that's going to be like my p of f and g. Oh, sorry. This is supposed to be j of f and g. And then we're going to take this thing right here, and that's going to be my Q of F and G. Okay? And one thing that we should say is that, where am I? P, what am I doing? I think I did it backwards. Sorry, yeah, this one is Q, this one is P. And we're going to note that P of F and G is actually equal to F times some R of G. Okay? So, by the way, these are all functions of T, X, and V. Sometimes I'll write, like over here I wrote F of V. That's because the T and X don't matter. You just pick a T and an X and you fix it, and that's that. Okay, so with this in mind, we have all these properties up here of these F, G, or F, whatever, P, J, Q, whatever, all of these. So the first one is what I just said. P of F and G is F times this R. This R is very nice because if you have like two functions and one is less than the other, then R of one is going to be R less than R of the other. So it like keeps the monotonicity. This thing right here, norm of P of FG is the same as the norm of P of GF. This norm, this is going to mean we're going to integrate F, actually, absolute value of these things in space and time, or space and velocity. Okay? And so on and so forth. So I wrote these down here because we're going to use them a lot for proving things. So what are we going to do? Okay, so G is any other. So in this case, F is the distribution of V, and G is the distribution of V star. It's like the probability density.
We are solving for F,
yes. And you notice in this equation, it's actually J of F and F. But I'm going to use that if you put a different one there, then, yeah. Okay, so let's rewrite this quickly. FT plus V dot grad X F. And then I'm going to say plus P of F and F is equal to Q of F and F. Okay. And then F of 0 is V. So what happens? What happens is that these are pretty ugly operators. So we have this F here, and look, it's P of F and F, which means this is going to be, if I replace this G with an F, that's what that's going to look like. So we have F of something times F of something else. It's not something that can be easily solved. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to replace this F by some other G. And let's pretend we know what G is. And this is just as ugly as P was. So what I'm going to do is I'm actually going to replace this whole thing with some H, which is some other function that we can pick. It doesn't really matter what it is. So let's call this 1. Okay. I'm going to solve this equation instead of the original Boltzmann. And when we solve it, we're going to find a way to use solutions to this problem to kind of construct the solution to the Boltzmann equation. So what we're going to do, we're going to define a new function. We're going to define F sharp of T. Well, it's F sharp of T, X, and V. And we're going to say that's equal to F of T, X plus T, V, and V. And it kind of makes sense to look at this because if you think about it, x plus tv, like if you start with t equals 0, you have phi of x and v, right? F of 0, xv is phi of xv. So you have your, at time 0, you have your x, and you know where it's going. And so let's say it's going this way at this velocity, and this is the time axis. Then x plus tv is going to be where this particle is going to end up after t seconds. Okay, so it's like you're following the trajectories of these particles. Although, we're not really going to care about the physical meaning of this. So, what we're going to do, we're going to define what it means to be a mild solution. So, F is a mild solution to our new equation if I take df sharp dt plus p of fg sharp is equal to h sharp. Okay, and f of 0 equals phi. Okay. Can anyone see why? First of all, how is this even related to, why do we care about this? How is it related to this? How are these two equations related? Does anyone have an idea?
Is that a linearization?
Yes, perfect. So if you look at the derivative of f sharp, remember how we defined it originally? Df sharp dt. So you take the partial with respect to t plus the partial with respect to x, but since we're in vectors, we're doing the gradient, times the derivative of x with respect to t, so that's going to be dotted with v, plus, the derivative of v with respect to t is 0, so we don't care about the last term. So we get this right here, which is exactly these two terms over here. And then we add p sharp, so that's what makes it different, is that instead of p, we have a p sharp over here, and instead of h, we have an h sharp. That's why it's a mild solution and not an actual solution. Okay, so, and why do we like this equation better than this one? Someone said it already. It's because we can solve that one. So, and we can't solve the first one. So, we have df sharp dt plus, and then this p of f and g, remember, from property, p1? That's actually f sharp times r of g sharp. Okay, and all of that is h sharp. This is a linear first order equation. We know how to solve that. If you remember integrating factors from your Diffie-Hugh class way back when, that's how we do it. So our f sharp, I'm going to write it up here. The solution, f sharp of t, equals. So we're going to have, where are we? We're going to have, okay, so it's phi e to the negative integral from 0 to t r of g sharp ds plus the integral from 0 to t of h sharp e to the negative integral, this is long, but r of g d sigma and then ds. Okay, so that's the equation for f sharp. Now, how are we going to use this to come back to the original Boltzmann equation and solve that? So, So what this is a mild solution of this simplified Boltzmann equation. Okay? So we found a mild solution to this, and we're going to use that to find the actual solution. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to find two sequences, un of t and ln of t. And they're going to be in such a way that if this is my f, if this is the solution to the actual Boltzmann equation, this ln, it's a sequence of functions that starts with some L naught that we can pick, and it increases, it goes up and up and up, and the idea is that it's supposed to approach this function f. And the uns are going to be the same way, except they go from the top down. So this is u naught, and we're going to keep making these blah, 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 un, and the idea is, well, we hope that they will approach our f. So how are we going to construct these functions? We're going to have a system of differential equations. Does everybody know this dot on top is the same as different derivative with respect to time? Okay. So this plus p of ln un minus 1 sharp equals q of ln minus 1 ln minus 1 sharp, and then un sharp dot plus p of un ln minus 1 sharp equals q of un minus 1 un minus 1 sharp. And then we're going to take the initial condition to be the same as it was for Boltzmann, so just phi. Okay, so these are linear equations. Notice that if it what we had before, it was like p of f and f. That's what made it so difficult. But here, ln is what we're solving for. Technically, you already know what ln minus 1 and un minus 1 are. So un minus 1 is known, so that can be like our g. And then ln is the one we're solving for. And then over here as well, this function can be our h, because again, this is depends on the previous ln's, which we already know. And same for the u's. So what we're going to prove is, if we have time, what we're going to prove is that when you do this, if you pick your u0 and of t and l0 of t correctly, then the sequences that follow based from these ones are actually going to converge, in fact, to the solution of Boltzmann. So the key thing, though, is that we need to pick these two in such a way that when you make L1 and U1 from these two, you want L1 to be bigger than L0, and you want U1 to be less than U0, and you want all the L's to be less than all the U's. Because remember, from this picture, the L's are always on the bottom, the U's are always on the top. So what we're going to prove right now is that once you pick, this, by the way, is called the starting condition. So if you start off like this, then these sequences will converge. Then it will like keep going. So let's do this lemma. So lemma if 0 less than or equal to L naught less than or equal to L1 less than or equal to U1 less than or equal to U naught, then, is that our only assumption? Yes. Then, after you make these two like that, the rest of the all the other ones will follow them. So then L2 is going to be less than that, and you go on forever. Ln is less than, and so on. And then Un will be less than Un minus 1, and so on until you get to U0. Okay. And by the way, once this is true, and so, once you get this result, it'll be obvious that both of these sequences converge. Do you know why? So if you... Exactly. So you know that monotone sequences always, bounded monotone sequences always converge. So once you establish that, you'll have your convergent sequences. So, and so, ln and un converge. Okay. Proof? I'm going to do the proof over here. It's actually quite simple. You basically use the definition of what un and ln are. So we're going to do this proof by induction. Okay, so for the base case, we know it's true, because that's our assumption. So base case is okay. You all know what proof by induction is, right? Okay, so now let's say, assume that it's true for k minus 1. So we're going to assume blah, 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 less than k lk minus 1, less than or equal to uk minus 1, blah, 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 to u naught. So what we're going to do, I'm going to write down, I can explicitly write down solutions to these things. Because remember, over here, those two equations with the un's and the ln's, those were exactly like this one. And we know how to solve that one. I wrote it on the board somewhere. I erased it, but we know the exact solutions. So lk minus 1, that's going to be phi e to the negative integral r of uk minus 2 sharp plus integral q of lk minus 2 lk minus 2 times e. Okay. I'm going to write r sharp. Well, no. I need to write the whole thing, actually. And then ds. Lk, I can also write the equation for that. I'm going to have phi e to the negative blah, blah, blah. It's exactly the same, except here I have uk minus 1 plus so on. I'm going to just write these two. Uk minus 1 here. DS. Okay, let's start here. So let's compare these two. These two terms, let's start with these two terms. So the phi is the same. The difference here is uk minus 2 and uk minus 1. That's the only difference between these two terms. Which one is bigger, uk minus 1 or uk minus 2? K minus 1 is bigger, right? So, and know that, where are we? By this property over here, if one is smaller than the other, then r of 1 is going to be smaller than, so r of uk minus 2 is less than r of uk minus 1, right? Or is it backwards? So the uk's are decreasing, so uk minus 1 is less than uk minus 2. Okay, so technically r of this is less than r of that. But then we have this minus sign. So it goes the other way around. So we have this inequality here. Look at these two terms. Lk minus 2 is less than Lk minus 1. And by property something, by property Q2, we know that if this is less than this, then Q of that is less than Q of that. So then we have this, bless you. And then we have the same thing up here, with the same thing here as we had here. So Lk minus 1 is less than or equal to Lk. And then you can keep going. You write it out for UK. You write it out for UK minus 1. And you're going to have the same thing. And you're going to compare the UK minus. You're going to have an Lk minus 1 here and UK minus 1. So it's going to, you keep going and it's going to work out. So we're done. Okay. So far we proved that our sequences are going to be nice and monotone and they're going to converge. Now what we're going to do is we're going to show that in fact they're going to converge to the same thing, and that thing will be the solution, mild solution to the Boltzmann equation. So, theorem. So we assume that the beginning condition is satisfied. And do we have to assume something else? I don't think so. Oh, and we assume that U and L are the corresponding limits, right? So UN goes to U, LN goes to L. Okay, then U equals L equals F, mild solution to Boltzmann. Okay, so let's start proving this thing. First of all, sometimes you can say that, you guys know the dominated convergence theorem? Maybe some of you do, maybe not everyone. Okay, so if un of t converges to u of t for all t, so basically if it converges pointwise, then if your functions are nice enough, you can say that if you integrate the difference, whatever, d. These are all t, x, v, by the way. Then that also goes to 0. And our functions are nice enough where they go to 0. So what we can say, now I'm gonna be using this norm notation because it's much easier. So we know that un minus u goes to 0, and that ln minus L goes to 0. Okay, so let's go on. We're going to use this property A right here. We know that the derivative of this plus blah, blah, blah equals this. So we're going to take this and we're going to integrate it in time. So what we're going to have, and then we're also going to move some things around after we do that. So we're going to end up with two things. We're going to end up with ln of t, norm of ln, plus integrate from 0 to t, norm of p ln un minus 1 ds equals integrate from 0 to t, norm of q ln minus 1 ln minus 1 ds. Okay, and we're going to have the same thing for un. Plus blah, 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 blah. Except this one is going to be p of un ln minus 1, and everything follows like you want it to. So what we're going to do is we're going to take the limit as m goes to infinity of both of these equations. So okay. So we're going to have, for u, we're going to have un turns into u plus integral from 0 to t norm of p and u, p of l u ds equals integral from 0 to t q norm of q of u ds. And same for L, except everything is reversed. Okay, and we're going to subtract these two from each other. So let me tell you the goal before we get lost in all these inequalities. The goal is we want to show that, so show that the norm of u minus l equals 0. Because once that happens, we immediately know that u is equal to l. Okay? So if we subtract one from the other, I'm going to have, so this minus that, u minus l. Okay, so technically it's the norm of u minus the norm of l, but since u and l are both positive and u is bigger than l, it's actually the same as this. Plus, okay, these terms are going to cancel out because of property P3, that if you flip this and integrate, the norm of this is the same as the norm of this. So these guys cancel. And what else cancels? These guys don't cancel. So u minus l equals the integral from 0 to t of, and actually, if I subtract this from the other, if you do the computations, it'll turn out to be it's equal to q of u minus l u plus l d. S. Okay, I don't have time to show why. It takes forever anyway. So just pretend that it's true. Okay, so we have this. And now here we go. So we start with this, and we're just going to have a bunch of inequalities that are going to lead us to zero. Yeah?
How does the u and the l end up in the same norm?
So that's the thing. Q of u minus q of L, you're just going to have to trust me on this.
No,
but
no, on the left side. Okay. More u minus
oh,
L.
Oh, because, okay, because both u and L are positive, which means that when I take u minus L, the norm of u minus the norm of L, and also, by the way, L is always less than u, less than or equal to u, when I take u minus L, it'll be the same as taking this. You can work it out. It's no, it's okay. If you have like the absolute value of 7 minus the absolute value of 5, that's the same as the absolute value of 7 minus 5, something like that. Yeah. Okay. So we're starting here, and we're just going to go on for a while, if we have time. We have time. Okay, so we're going to use, now we're just going to use all those properties. This thing right here, by property Q3, is less than or equal to, if I were to take, is going to be C times the norm of P of U minus L, and u plus l, which in turn is actually equal to c. So remember that P by property P1, P is actually this thing times R of this thing. So let's just write that right away. So it's actually U minus L times R of U plus L. Okay. Next. So one thing we're assuming that I never told you is that U and L are both bounded by Maxwellians times a constant. So U is less than or equal to some constant times e to the negative alpha v squared, and L is less than some other constant e to the negative alpha v squared. So that means that when you add them, they'll also be less than some constant times that Maxwellian. So we are going to say this is less than or equal to integral from 0 to t c times u minus l times r of, we can call this c times Maxwellian m alpha ds. And we know by property something else, P4, that r of a Maxwellian is less than or equal to p lambda, c times p lambda. And p lambda is just 1 plus absolute value v to the lambda. So this ends up being less than or equal to the integral from 0 to t of, so I'm going to put the c in the front. I'm combining all the c's together to one big constant, so we don't have to worry about it. So we'll have u minus l, norm of u minus l, times 1 plus norm of v to the lambda ds. Okay, so we're going to end here. 5 minutes. So that last thing, we are going to break it up. We're going to break that up. So remember that a norm is a double integral, actually, right, from up here. So what we're going to say is, where am I? Let's just look at the stuff inside the integral. So let's just look at the norm of P lambda times U minus L. Okay. So, which is integral over V, integral over R3, P lambda, 1 plus V to the lambda times U minus L dV dx. Okay. We're going to break this R3 into the following. So we're going to say R3 is going to be the sphere of radius n centered at 0 plus the sphere of radius n complement, right? So the sphere and the rest of the sphere. So we're going to break that into those two integrals. The 1 over Sn, we can say that if it's inside the sphere, then absolute value of v is less than n. Times u minus l dv. What else? How does this go? So we're just going to have that this thing over here, when you take the other integral, is going to be bounded by c times 1 plus n to the lambda times norm of u minus l. And we're going to leave it at that for now. And then the other one, when you're outside the sphere, if you take integral over Sn complement, so 1 plus v to the lambda. What do we do here? Okay, so u minus l is once again bounded by a Maxwellian. So some constant up here times e to the negative alpha v squared dv dx. We're going to break this thing into negative alpha over 2 v squared minus alpha over 2 v squared. The reason why I'm doing that is because one of these guys is going to be less than or equal to negative alpha over 2 n squared, because now v is bigger than n. So when you have a negative thing here, you have that inequality. So I'm going to take that out. C times e to the negative alpha over 2 n squared times integral over v, integral over sn, 1 plus v to the lambda times the rest of that stuff, dv dx. Okay. The reason why I'm doing this is because this right here, when you have any polynomial multiplied by a Maxwellian and you integrate it, it's always going to be finite because this thing is just that strong. You multiply it against any polynomial, you always have a finite value. So this is some constant. And I'm going to put this constant inside of this one, so I'm just going to say the whole thing is less than or equal to C e to the negative alpha over 2 n squared. So when we go back to that last thing we had before we broke it up, so we had the integral from 0 to t of norm of u minus v, u minus l times 1 plus v to the lambda ds. That's going to end up being less than or equal to the integral from 0 to t of everything we just got, which is first we had c times 1 plus n to the lambda times norm of u minus l ds, and then plus the last thing we got was just a constant. When you integrate a constant with respect to time, you just get t times the constant. So t times c e to the negative alpha over 2 n squared. And we're almost done. So this was all from u minus v, u minus l. So we started off with u minus l, right? So we got up to here. And now, I don't know if you know Gronwald's inequality. No? I'm assuming not, because it's probably doesn't come up very often, but maybe some of you know it. Gronwald's inequality basically says that if you have y of t less than or equal to alpha of t plus integral of y of s beta of s ds from 0 to t, and all of these functions are nice enough, then y of t is actually going to be less than or equal to alpha of t times e to the negative integral of beta of s ds. No negative, just integral. So we're going to use Gronwald's inequality here. This is going to be like our y. This is our beta. This is our alpha. So this is actually less than or equal to, so alpha t times c e to the negative alpha over 2 n squared times e to the integral of this beta, c times 1 plus n to the lambda ds. But since it doesn't depend on t, we just get rid of this and add a t. And then we just have c times t times e to the tc times e to the 1, what am I doing? Yeah, n to the tc n to the lambda all over e to the alpha over 2n squared. And here is where we use the fact that lambda is less than 2. So that's important because remember that n was the radius of that sphere we had. That sphere that we broke up R3 into a sphere and everything outside the sphere, n was arbitrary, which means you can take the limit as n goes to infinity. And when you take the limit as n goes to infinity, because lambda is less than 2, we get 0. So what do we have? U minus L is less than or equal to 0. We know it's also bigger than or equal to 0, so they have to be equal. So U and L are equal, proving that they're also the solution to the Boltzmann equation. That's just easy. I'm not going to do that. But you basically like take the equation and then integrate the original equation and then take the limit as n goes to infinity, and it works out nicely. So we have shown that there exists a solution. We actually haven't found it. One thing I'd like to mention, actually a couple of things. This problem is still open because, first of all, this is just a mild solution. And secondly, and most importantly, is that, three things. The second thing that I want to say is that, remember in the beginning when I wrote out the actual collision operator, it was like that ugly integral, and then there was like this B for the cross-sectional area, and I said that that thing has to be bounded or integrable. Okay, well, that thing, that makes no physical sense. Once, if it's bounded and integrable, that's not real. So it turns into an abstract problem. And that's making that assumption is actually what makes this thing possible. Without it, we wouldn't be able to split it into the P and the Q, and we wouldn't be able to do everything we just did. So that's the first thing. The second thing is, it's really hard to pick out your U-naught and L-naught to make that starting condition possible. So this theorem assumed that the starting condition already assumed that it was true. But actually picking out your U-naught and L-naught is really hard. And like you can like try different things. You can try making them like really small. And then that'll give you only a solution for a very short period of time. You can try making your phi, your initial data, really, really small, and then you could have a solution for all time, but again, your phi is really small. So you always have to sacrifice something to get what you want. So this was the first ever proposed solution for or type of solution for a very simplified Boltzmann problem. And this was done in 1979, I think. And the rest, right now, it's still an open problem. So we have no idea what to do. We've been able to make that's called the grad assumption, that the B is integrable. We've been able to say, well, what if it has this type of singularity? Well, can we do it that way? What if it has some other type of singularity? But anyway, it's a work in progress. So, yeah. I guess I'm done.
Things could you do to improve the mild solution to make it better
to
model of something that you're doing? Like, what types of things would you do?
So,
is it based on like the error of your measurements that you're doing, or is it?
Well, there are no measurements. What do you mean by measurements?
So, like, if you're trying to predict the probability that a particle is doing something.
Right.
Box.
Yeah.
How would you improve that? Like, what?
From the mild solution to the actual solution?
Yeah. Or how would you get a better mild solution? Like, what would you do?
The mild solution is unique.
Oh, it is.
Yeah. There's only one of it. I guess I didn't prove uniqueness here either, but that's a whole other story. I mean, it took me this long to just prove existence, right? So, the mild solution is unique. Sometimes you don't need the actual solution to, well, sometimes it's enough to have something that's not the exact solution to come up with properties of the actual solution that would help you get there. So, of course, the goal is to find a solution, the actual solution to the Boltzmann equation, but mild solutions and weak solutions, all of those also kind of work, because our initial data might not be as continuous. So first of all, I sugarcoated this a lot for you guys. These functions are not continuous necessarily. They're all in Lebesgue spaces. I don't know if you know what Lebesgue spaces are. And in order to make these theorems all work, there's a lot of modifications that have to be done that I have left out. So it's okay to have a weak solution because it might not be possible to find a real solution because the equation itself has derivatives. And you don't even know if the function is continuous, right? Solution doesn't have to be, it can be really messy, but it would still be a solution. So that's what I mean when I say weak solution. So the actual solution, no one knows. How to get there, no one knows. Open problem. So, yeah.
I have a question about the collision operator. Mm-hmm. So what exactly is it, and how is it? Is it like a model that we assume that the...
That's a model. Deriving that thing, it took me like 4 months to figure it out, and I still don't think I understand it completely. It comes from physics, and I'm really bad at physics. So, yeah.
Part of the problem could be that the collision operator is not... I mean, you were trying to solve the Boltzmann transport equation. Does that have that specific...
Yeah, okay. That is the equation, yeah. Yeah. I mean, Boltzmann came up with it, so I don't know if, like, I'm assuming it's the right thing. Just like any other equation that's supposed to model a physical phenomenon, I mean, it's, yeah, deriving those equations is I don't know, yeah.
Is it a problem sensitive to initial
data? I'm not sure, actually.
Solution?
Well, I mean, yeah, we are. That's how we figured this out. That's how we solved it in the first place.
Yeah, but that's not the real solution.
That's a mild solution. Can we approximate? So that's a question that goes to the people. So there are like people in ISIS that are doing all these computations. They're like actually modeling this stuff. And then there's me. I'm just playing around with abstract things. So I don't really know. I'm sure, yeah, it has been done. I've seen pictures of possible solutions. So, but yeah, I don't know, to be honest, if it's sensitive to initial data. Qualitative?
Like, I guess things like, you know, are there, if you start with, like, really low velocities, is it possible for particles to get up to super high velocities? Or, like,
So right now we're assuming that, this actual speed doesn't change. So there's no, like, energy loss. In reality, of course there is. And there are other models that work with that and, like, electric charges and all of that. But you're just bouncing around. Like you don't change. There's no external force that would cause the velocity to increase or the speed to increase. Collision operator? Yeah. So there's a symmetry property that the new velocity of one is the old velocity of the other. So whether or not the actual particles do that, so this is all a probability density function. So yeah, so I guess I wouldn't be able to answer that. But I'm pretty sure that it's not possible given the assumptions. Yeah.